School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The struggling nation of Yemen is on the brink of what could become the worst famine the world has seen in decades. Now, one misconception about famines is that they're usually caused by natural disaster, like droughts. In fact, they're nearly always caused by humans. And Yemen's crisis is no different. The country's economy has collapsed amid a three-year-old civil war involving a Saudi-led coalition backed by the U.S. and a militia from northern Yemen called the Houthis, who have received aid from Iran. Now, more than three-quarters of Yemen's population of 29 million is in need of humanitarian aid. Of that group, about 8.4 million are what the UN calls, quote, severely food insecure and at risk of starvation. Now, to make matters worse, it's increasingly clear that the humanitarian disaster in Yemen isn't an unintended side effect of the war, but a deliberate effort to starve the population. On this edition of Global Journalist, a closer look at the three-year-old crisis in Yemen and why more isn't being done to end the world's worst humanitarian disaster. We're going to hear a number of different perspectives on this, but to start, we're joined by Jane Ferguson, a special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. She joins us from Istanbul, Turkey, but she was in Yemen just a few months ago and was able to get into parts of the country normally off limits to journalists. Jane, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, you were in Yemen earlier this year, and you would think there would be a lot of media focus on a humanitarian disaster of this scale and scope, and that's not actually the case, especially in northern Yemen. Talk to us about what the challenges are of reporting from there.
There are a number of challenges. There are a number of reasons why you don't see a lot of images from there. You don't see a lot of major network reports from that part of the country, and it's important to point out that part of the country has around 80% of the population, the majority live in Houthi-controlled areas. One of the reasons is that the Saudi-led coalition that the United States supports, it has made great efforts to make it difficult for journalists to access that part of the country, to be able to fly into Sana'a, for instance, the capital that is held by the rebels, that only United Nations flights are allowed in there, and those it's banned for journalists or human rights researchers to get on those flights. That makes access very difficult.
Banned by who? Who is preventing journalists, human rights researchers from getting in?
The Saudi-led coalition. The Saudis control the airspace because of the blockade on Yemen. So they get a say on who gets on what airplanes and who's allowed on the manifests of specific flights. So they get to approve the flights that are allowed to land into Yemen. Journalists aren't allowed on those United Nations flights. So some journalists like myself and some others have been allowed onto flights into Aden, which is within the coalition controlled areas of Yemen. But then in order to get into rebel-held areas, we've had to smuggle ourselves in. It's a dangerous way, and it's very difficult to be able to do that. That puts major news organizations off. It's risky. It's very difficult to do. It's a logistical challenge. On the other hand, there's also, as has been discussed widely, not as much attention focused on Yemen generally as a war. I think that, you know, certainly stateside right now, international news generally is struggling to compete with the constant noise and updates coming out of Washington, D.C. and the White House there. So, you know, foreign news hasn't exactly been high on the agenda lately. And for Yemen, I think it's a hard sell for some of the news organizations to understand exactly how the United States has a role in this war and how it's relevant to the news agenda in the United States.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the humanitarian situation there, because you did get sort of extraordinary access by smuggling yourself in to these Houthi-controlled areas. You met this 11-year-old girl, I think her name was Maimona Shagadar, in a health clinic there, who was in really awful shape. Tell us her story.
Sure. We were in an area called Hadja, which is just about northwest of Sana'a, about 4 or 5 hours drive up into the mountains. It's a very rural area. It's a province, and we were in the capital town called Hadja as well. In the main hospital there, we were in the children's ward. As with all children's wards in Yemen that you seem to visit, they're largely basically now malnutrition wards. You go to these children's wards and 90% of the patients there are malnourished or outright starving. And we were filming there for the day. We'd just arrived about an hour or two before. We'd been filming for a little while, some of the cases there, mothers and babies. And a young man in his early 20s, himself very, very thin, came sort of racing in, holding what looked like a little bundle of clothes, and just sort of gently sat it down on one of the gurneys. And it was an 11-year-old girl called Maimona. And she was purely she looked like a little bag of bones and skin. And she was still breathing. For a horrible moment, we thought that she might die. And the nurses came rushing over. They gave her IV fluids. And as we were filming this, and as we spent more time with her and her brother, we got to understand the story of what had happened to this family. Her mother came the next day as well. And we found out that effectively Maimona was coming from a household that had run out of any income over 2 years before. Her father, and this is what's so tragic about her situation and so scary for Yemen, is that her father had been a school teacher at a government school, which would have meant effectively they would have been a fairly middle-class family. And yet here their children were starving, because any government salaries that many people worked for the government as bureaucrats, school teachers, office workers, those salaries stopped 2 years ago. And so effectively the family had run out of any real way of feeding themselves. And as we know the world over, that it's children who suffer first. And Maimona was simply horribly malnourished. And as we've seen with thousands of children in Yemen, being malnourished made her very, very unwell, which made her sick, which made her dehydrated, which brought her to the brink of death by the time her brother had got her to this hospital.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that point, because you reported that 11 years old, she weighed 24 pounds, I believe. But if you could, I mean, you were touching on something here about the collapse of Yemen's economy. And in some ways, that sounds somewhat different as a cause of a famine here. I mean, what's striking to you about what is causing this famine?
It is an economic collapse. Effectively, you know, what Maimona's case, what her family's case shows is that, you know there's food in Yemen. There's plenty of food. You visit restaurants and markets and stalls and supermarkets. There's plenty of food. What is being denied, what is being taken away from people, is the ability to buy any food. People have no incomes, effectively. That's because the economy has collapsed, and the economy has collapsed as a result of the war, but not simply because there's fighting or because there are airstrikes. The economy has collapsed because of the tactics of this war. Effectively, Houthi-controlled areas have been cut off. Government salaries. Now, the government of Yemen was the biggest employer by far before this war happened. It was a huge bureaucracy. If one person had a job in the government, they could be supporting 20 family members. Those salaries were cut off 2 years ago, whenever the internationally recognized government moved the central bank to the south. So there have been tactics that have cut off people's income.
And just and our time grows short, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but these are tactics that have been employed by the Saudi coalition that has been supported by the US, the UK, other Western allies.
That's correct. They're supported logistically. We know that they're supported with weapons, intelligence, and logistics. And yes, so there has been an attempt to really try to crush economically as well the area that the Houthis control in Yemen. And unfortunately, tragically, one of the side effects is that people go without any income, and therefore they go without food.
Well, Jane Ferguson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, a closer look at Yemen, home of the world's worst humanitarian disaster. We just heard from Jane Ferguson, a special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, reporting about the situation in that country. Now, for another perspective, we're going to bring in someone who is on the ground in Yemen now. Joining us from the Houthi rebel-controlled capital Sana'a is Johan Moy. He's the Yemen country director for CARE, one of the aid organizations responsible for distributing humanitarian relief. Johan, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you have worked for aid organizations for many years. How does the situation in Yemen now compare with other places where you've worked?
It is the magnitude of the problem. We're talking about millions of people who are food insecure that need to be fed. And I've worked in places like Iraq and East Africa, and you talk about hundreds of thousands, but here we're talking about millions. And it is an incredible disaster really happening, and it's been getting worse over the last 2 years, 3 years, and we're not seeing the end of it. So we're all trying to scale up our efforts to reach out to more people, and You mentioned the 8 million people that are in need of food. CARE is supporting about 1 million of them. Others are doing their best, but the problem only gets worse as the conflict continues.
Well, what is the situation where you are now in Sana'a? Do you see malnourished people walking about on the street? Jane Ferguson mentioned that there is food in the country.
Yeah, it's amazing what is happening in this country that has it's not been a rich country, but for a long time, many Yemeni were working abroad and were sending their income back to Yemen, and the Yemeni were able to import food where needed. So you could say there is food, but there is no money. So one of our main interventions is really cash distributions. We give families that we've selected because of their conditions, and we provide them with money up to $100 a month to feed their family. And with that money, they are able to get and buy food in the market.
And so it sounds like then people can purchase food because food is there, but they literally have no income because there are no jobs. Yemen has been sealed off. These people who were working in Saudi Arabia and other countries have all been sent home or are no longer able to remit their earnings back to Yemen, it sounds like. But talk to us just about the situation where you are. How close is the fighting or the aerial bombardment to where you are in Sana'a?
Well, we've had a lot of airstrikes here in Sana'a. It has come down a bit. Because of the fighting in Hodeidah, the coalition is trying to capture one of the major cities on the west coast, on the Red Sea. And the specifics about this place is that it has a big port, and about 75% of the imports into the country come through that port.
And this is the port city of Hodeidah.
Exactly. And previously, with at least 600,000 people living in the city, I think maybe half of the population has already fled. And there has been heavy fighting over this last week for the coalition to kind of capture the city, but I think also capture the port. But what we fear is that commercial imports and humanitarian imports will come to an end, and that would create an immediate disaster on top of what we already have.
So this port then, which is controlled by the Houthi rebels who control most of the population in Yemen, it sounds like it's sort of the lifeline for food and supplies coming into the country here. But I just want to touch on something that Jane Ferguson raised in the first segment. And it sounds like, you know, sort of unlike maybe some other huge humanitarian crises we've seen, one of the biggest threats to civilians in Yemen is inflation, of all things. Can you talk to us just about how price increases and the devaluation of the currency are impacting people?
Yeah, up to about 3 months ago, the prices were relatively stable. The exchange rate was about 500 Yemeni rial to a dollar. But we've seen over the last couple of months that there has been a huge hike in prices. The exchange rate in the black market is now about 700 rial to a dollar, and you can tell in the market prices have gone up. And as Jane said, there is no money in this country. Yeah? There's very little. So as soon as prices go up and people don't have access to dollars or international money and just Yemeni money, it's far less. The worth is far less, and people suffer now. The you won't see any dying people in the streets, but people are getting more and more vulnerable. They die in their homes. And I visited the hospital, saw similar images of what we've seen before, is people are malnourished and people die in the hospitals or die at home because people cannot afford. And I think even the exchange rate is part of a scheme to influence the situation in Yemen.
Well, Johan Moy, our time grows very short here, but what is there just one thing that could help alleviate the situation in Yemen? What could people in America, somewhere else, do to help?
Well, I've been, and with me, a lot of other NGOs have been saying the fighting needs to stop. There needs to be some kind of a ceasefire, a halt in in the fighting so that there is time to negotiate. And Yemeni tell me if this would be a Yemeni fight only, they would find a solution. The situation has become complex because of the intervention of the Saudis and the Emirati, the Americans, the Iranians. But we need, the population needs some rest and some time. So let the fighting stop and let foreign nations who are befriended with those who fight use their influence and their friendship, you can call it like that, let them use that to bring a stop to the fighting.
And, well, Johan, and we've heard, we're just out of time here, but I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about Yemen, where a brutal civil war has led to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and more than 8 million people are facing starvation. Now, to expand our discussion, we're going to bring in another person who has been following Yemen closely. Joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, is Heba Kanso. She's a correspondent for the Thomson Reuters Foundation, who covers the Middle East. Heba, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Heba, if I could start with you. There's a technical definition of what the UN and aid organizations officially refer to as a famine. And in Yemen's case, it sounds like it's not quite there, but almost. So explain to us in layman's terms about how this is defined.
Sure. So within my reporting, I've noticed that a lot of NGOs and groups, they use the word on the brink of famine, or sliding into famine, or the edge, or facing famine. They're very careful not to say that Yemen is in famine now. And the United Nations uses guidelines known as the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC. And three main things need to be part of that. So at least one in five households have to be facing extreme lack of food. And more than 30% of children under five have to be suffering from acute malnutrition. And the last thing is at least two people out of every 10,000 have to be dying every day. So there are specific guidelines that the United Nations does follow to declare famine. And as you know, the last time, you know, this was declared, the man-made famine, was in Sudan last year. So it is a very politically heavily charged word, and it has not been officially used. But like I said, we've been hearing this from across, you know, all groups and all NGOs, that they've been saying brink, sliding into, edge, facing. So they've been very careful not to actually say that it is declared.
And Johan Moy of CARE, if I could bring you back into the conversation here, tell us if you would, I mean, is there a story of a family or some people that you think maybe sort of describe or give a picture of the scope or the causes of this famine or humanitarian crisis?
As humanitarian workers, we have access to most areas in Yemen. And so once in a while, I travel up country. A couple of weeks ago, I went to a place called Amran, which is northwest of Sana'a. And I went to a group of people who had fled Hodeidah recently. And actually, they had been fleeing for the last couple of years from one place to the next. But because of the fighting in Hodeidah, they had to flee again, ended up in Amran, found a piece of land where they were hoping to be for a while, but they were told by the authorities to leave there. Now, it was incredible. I mean, I've seen people in my life who have been suffering, but these people, they had nothing left. And they were squatting on this piece of land. CARE was not allowed to dig pit latrines for these people. We were allowed to put a large container with drinking water there, but nobody really wanted these people in the middle of town, which to some extent you can understand. But they offered these people a piece of land on top of a graveyard in the same town. And I mean, can it get any worse than, you know, you have to flee for your life, and hundreds of thousands of people had to move. You come to a city and then you're pushed away again to a graveyard. I mean, it doesn't get any worse. And these people were showing me their children, and one of the men took his child up by the leg. I thought it was a terrible sight, but and while he did that, he undressed the child and just to show that the child was malnourished. And I saw people with big blisters and scars, and it was a truly sad story. And it's really the story of Yemen, where people are being pushed out of their homes for so long, because the war isn't static. The war is it moves. There's about 30 different fronts in this country, and as soon as one of the party moves, a lot of people have to leave their homes. There are about a couple of million people who have fled their homes. And although the Yemeni in general are very generous and hospitable, they will share for a long time. But there is so little to share. And I feel that this war should really stop. They call it a man-made disaster, and it is truly a man-made disaster. And we're humanitarians, so we can do a lot. The famine is not a situation we cannot handle. We can handle, for the short run, a famine like this by handing out food. But the fighting parties should really come together. And I think there are friends and stakeholders and governments who can do more to stop this crisis by pushing those who were involved, and by linking up with the Houthis, linking up with the Emiratis and the Saudis to see how this war can be stopped without trying to win it. Well, because the Houthis are not from far. They live in this country. They come from this country. And so the solution needs to be a Yemeni solution inside Yemen.
Well, thanks so much for that, Johan. But if I could turn this back to Heba Khan. So one of the places, as we have talked about, is one of the areas that is most significant in Yemen is that there's been this huge outbreak of cholera there. What do we know about the scope and scale of that?
Well, we do know from, based off of, again, my reporting and talking to humanitarian aid agencies, is that the situation was pretty awful last year when there was a blockade, because with cholera it is treatable, and that's what's sad about it, is that so many children are the ones that are most vulnerable and are the first to be hit by this, and then this year the World Health Organization had said that roughly 10,000 suspected cholera cases are now reported per week, which again is something that is treatable, but it does get affected when things are blocked, like clean water and access to medicine to actually help the situation. So it is a deadly cycle for children.
We know that after the central bank was moved from Sana'a under Houthi control to Aden a couple of years ago, where the Saudi coalition is in charge, the government just stopped paying the salaries of all civil servants, doctors, teachers, as Jane Ferguson referenced. How did that impact the civilian population?
Yeah, you're right. Jane did mention that. When actually more recently, the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council had made a plea to British lawmakers to actually create a fund to pay some of these teachers and doctors that haven't been paid, like what Jane said, up to 2 years, which is pretty severe. And so a lot of these people ended up leaving their posts. And that obviously contributes to the health sector within the country. It contributes to the education sector within the country. You also have like a lack of people who are in these positions. So in order to help bring back people into these sectors, that's what the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council had recommended. But like also what Jane mentioned, it is a cycle within the economy. There just is. There is no money. People don't have money to buy food. People don't have money to pay people. So within these, public sector jobs, people are not getting paid.
And Heba, of course, as you mentioned, vulnerable people are most affected by this sort of crisis. You've done some reporting on how a certain group of women especially are being affected in Hodeidah, this port city where a lot of fighting is going on right now. Talk to us about the risks to them there.
Sure. In particular, it's pregnant women, pregnant women who do need medical care and who eventually need breast milk to feed their babies. I spoke to one woman this year who fled Hodeidah period because she was so worried about her unborn child as well as her children who she had, because she, first of all, there was fighting, so it was an unstable situation for her and her family. And second of all, she didn't know what was going to happen the next day. I mean, we spoke over WhatsApp, and you know, there was a lot of fear for her, because providing for her family, I mean, just the basics of getting bread and water. And it's like that, you know, with anybody who reports on this, whether you're inside the country or outside of it, it's very clear that people don't even, you know, to buy basic water, food, you know, those baseline necessities. And they obviously affect the most vulnerable, like we had just talked about, you know, children who are malnourished, children who are desperate for food, women who are pregnant or who are nursing that need that care that is really not available, especially in Hodeidah, where it has been a very volatile area. Obviously, the fighting has calmed within the last day or two, but it is a very, very difficult situation for these vulnerable people, and based off of what humanitarian workers say.
And Heba, if I could ask you, I mean, this war is very much seen as being sort of thought up and carried out by Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. And we know that some of the politics and perception around him has changed since the killing of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. I mean, can you tell us if, you know, is there any reason for optimism that this war may be resolved peacefully in the coming months?
Well, what is a fact in all of this, especially as a journalist that has been reporting on Yemen from Beirut, is that Jamal Khashoggi's death has definitely put a spotlight on this issue, because, you know, Yemen was brought into focus and Yemen's involvement within the war was brought into focus. So all of that had a tumbling effect. And then that has caused the West, like the United States and the UK, to try to put an end to this with a ceasefire. So his death really has put this war more into a spotlight. And whether or not, you know, his death is going to be the factor that changes the outcome of this war or, you know, puts an end to this war, I can't say that as a journalist. But what is very much true is that his death has definitely put the war and put the people involved in this war and the countries involved in this war under a very, very clear and sharp microscope.
Well, Heba Kanso, thanks so much for joining us. We're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Jane Ferguson, Johan Moy, and Heba Kanso for joining us. Our assistant producers for this program are Chris Kroonen and Jae Shi. Yanxi Xu is our supervising producer. Maggie Duncan is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.